Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven, saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you're already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is April 11, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for our installment dealing with communism, this one in regards to the Spanish Civil War. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. Now, before we get into the meat of it, suffice to say the Spanish Civil War was the work of leftists and Jews, and they were trying to do to Spain what they had done to the Russian Empire and what they had tried to do in Bavaria, what they tried to do in Berlin with the Spartacist League, what the Freikorps put down in Germany, Franco put down in Spain.
Well, right, it's absolutely true. And it's hard to uncover good material on Spain. I've been trying for 2 weeks. Much of the revisionist material available on the Spanish Civil War still favors the so-called Republic inside. Its purveyors advertise the Republican period as a chance, and I found websites that lament this, as a chance for a pure form of Marxism to develop, which was ruined by the so-called fascists. And basically, the communist parties and their non-Jewish members spread throughout the West were, for the most part, in the 1930s, blind to the evils of Talmudic communism and the horrors of Bolshevism, which are so well kept out of the mainstream press by the Jewish masters. And they still are. Most of them still are.
Well,
they still don't understand it.
I've seen History Channel documentaries, and they put all these veterans from the Abraham Lincoln Brigades up there, and they talk about how great it was. They had to fight fascism, and they were the first to go to Europe to fight the evils of the Nazis, the Italian fascists, the Spanish nationalists who were backed by evil Hitler and evil Mussolini. But they never once talk about how all of their communist comrades were raping nuns, butchering priests, and chopping people to pieces.
Well, you know, I have this movie I just put up on the Mein Kampf site, Wales and the Spanish Civil War. And they interview these old Welshmen that had gone and fought for the Republicans, which are the communists in Spain. That they called themselves the Republicans, and after the Republic of 1931, which was never really a republic, and these Welshmen actually, one of them actually equated Christianity with communism. He thought the two were one and the same.
He's insane.
Well, they just didn't know any better. That they were miners that were out of work for the most of them. That there were 200 Welshmen that went and fought in Spain for the communists. And they were all communists. Most of the international brigades, well, I would probably be safe to say that all of the international brigades in every country where men were organized through labor unions, and most of those men were unemployed or down and out, where they were organized, they were all organized by local communist and local communist parties.
Mm-hmm.
The Abraham Lincoln Brigade was all communist.
In fact, those men had to go through the Soviet embassy. They had to deal with the Soviet diplomats. I think a lot of them had to go to the Soviet Union to begin with, and then they were smuggled into Spain. But they didn't just hop on a plane in New York and fly to Madrid.
Right. And to this day, most of the material I found, its purveyors refused to see the purely Soviet hand which attempted to Bolshevize Spain in the 1930s. And I'm going to quote. I'd like to quote about a paragraph and a half from a mainstream academic named George Essedwine, which supports the position that most people don't see the Bolshevik hand, and even many Marxist sympathizers today refuse to see, who comment on the Spanish-American War, refuse to see that the Bolsheviks in Soviet Russia were behind it.
Well,
and we'll see that Essenwine also falls victim to propaganda from the era, even though he's an academic, because he actually seems to buy into the idea that the Republicans were fighting fascists, when in fact most of Franco's forces were not fascists.
And before you start, I just wanted to say that they have to be blind to it. They can't see it, because if they see it and they continue doing what they're doing, they'd have to know on some level that they're hypocrites, and they don't want to have to live with that.
Well, absolutely. I'd like to quote from Essenwine. This is The Spanish Civil War, A Modern Tragedy, page 5. It is noteworthy that revisionist historians of this school tend to discount much of the evidence used to support the anti-communist judgments found in the so-called Cold War literature on the war. This is particularly true of the memoirs of personal testimonies written by ex-communists, notably Julian Gorkin and Walter Kravitsky, both Jews, who, whether justly or not, became identified as Cold War warriors, because testimonies produced by this group are based largely on individual experiences and are frequently marred by personal prejudices. The revisionists maintain that they are little or no use to the serious historian. On the other hand, the recent unearthing of documentary evidence unearthing of new documentary material relating to the communists' role in Spain has served only to undermine the popular front interpretation outlined above. Records relating to the Soviets and communists' role in Spain during the Civil War that have been buried in the military, Communist Party, and state archives in Russia for nearly 60 years tend to confirm the view that the communists, one, played a dominant role in determining Republican affairs during the last year and a half of the war, and I would say it was sooner than that, and two, employed both subversive and coercive tactics to achieve their political goals. For example, the British writer Gerald Halson has recently published an expose of the communists' role in supplying armaments to the Republic. They've been denying this for 60 years. His researchers demonstrate not only that the Soviets provided far less aid than previously thought, rather than supply the Republicans with the latest and best military equipment, they sold them out-of-date guns and insufficient numbers. In other words, the Soviets were taking advantage of the Republicans.
So much for international comrades.
They systematically defrauded the Republicans by cooking the books on the exchange rates. Above all, Halson's meticulous research into the arms question seriously undermines the revisionist view that Soviets ought to be viewed simply as representatives of the progressive forces on the Republican side who are attempting to prevent another European democratic government from succumbing to the forces of fascism. No, they had been behind the whole thing from the beginning. And even Essenwine buys the fact that the adversaries to the Republicans were fascists. Other recent publications that force us to focus our attention on the empirical foundations of the revisionist debate are the various collections of Soviet and Comintern documents that have been published by Yale University in its documentary series called The Annals of Communism. This is particularly true of the volume devoted to the Spanish Civil War. And the Soviets had a huge hand in the Spanish Civil War. And I've seen much information the last 2 weeks on the internet that denies that still. That they really believe, there's a lot of people that really believe that the Spanish Civil War, the Republic of Spain, was moving towards a pure non-Bolshevik form of Marxism.
Absolutely not.
That's absolutely a lie.
And in fact, without Soviet intervention, without Soviet help, there wouldn't really have been a Republican war effort, would there?
Well, no, there wouldn't have been. And the Soviets were behind the organization of communist militias, more or less, militia units to travel from other countries to Spain to join the Republican side. And 1,200 Canadians went. 200 men from Wales went. A couple of hundred Americans went. It's incredible. And they when they came back to America, and I have this on the Mein Kampf site, they were welcomed with open arms. And there were all kinds of appeals in America for help to the Republican side, and they were all orchestrated by the Jewish-controlled American media. And the New York Times is actually gloats about that. And they gloat about it to this day on their website.
They were lauded as heroes. In fact, here, let's see, the co-founder of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and the general secretary, Moses Fishman, born in New York City. I'll let you figure out his ethnicity.
I have a New York Times article on the Mein Kampf site. I took the entire article from the New York Times archives, and it opens up. And it's about a museum exhibition on the Spanish Civil War. If there are any doubts about and there's some good pictures there also. If there are any doubts about the deep longing we have to believe in heroes, to discover those with superior courage, vision, and commitment, and then to celebrate their accomplishments, the new exhibition at the Museum of the City of New York should put those doubts to rest. Facing Fascism, New York and the Spanish Civil War, which opened yesterday, is in full celebration mode. And this is the New York Times today celebrating the Spanish Civil War and the Americans that fought in it. And they were fighting for Bolshevism. They weren't fighting for democracy and freedom. They were fighting for communists.
And you have to wonder, how many priests did they kill while they were there? How many nuns did they rape while they were there? And they come back and say, we fought for freedom.
And they were not fighting fascists. While the Falange, or the fascist party in Spain, was on Franco's side, that's basically because they agreed with the traditionalists and the Catholic middle class in Spain, which made up over three quarters of Franco's nationalist side. They were nationalists. They were not fascists. Most of them were nationalist Catholics who loved traditional Spain and wanted to defend it. A great portion of them were monarchists who wanted the monarchy back, and then a good number of them were fascists, but fascists weren't even the majority. It's incredible that the mainstream media narrows this down, and they have since the very beginning, and they narrow it down to the people who wanted democracy, which was the Republicans, and they were really, for the most part, the Republicans and the parties that made up the Republican side were radical leftists and Marxists. And the so-called fascists were some of them were fascists, but most of them were Catholic traditionalists and the white working middle class of Spain.
Absolutely. It was just a counter-revolution of the ordinary people. Whereas the communists would say the workers and peasants, the people they claim support them, but never do.
Right. Well, I'd like to get into this Barnes Review article, and we'll get back to this at the end, and we'll discuss some of these Spanish political parties and who was behind them. Just some background first is that this really began in 1931 and not 1936. It began in 1931 when the King of Spain abdicated. Alfonso XIII abandoned his throne. He abdicated his throne because anti-monarchist forces dominated the 1931 elections. And most of those parties were radical leftist parties that dominated the 1931 elections.
Set up by Moscow.
He felt as though the only way to not have a civil war was to abdicate his throne and to leave Spain, which he did. And yes, that was set up in great part by Moscow, and it was agitated by communists. And the communists, it can be shown that the communists are a minority of the left, but they really don't care about most of the left because most of them are socialists and moderates, and it's very much like we saw in the Bolshevist Revolution, where the left was divided, but the most radical element always seemed to win out because they're willing to go to the furthest extremes.
Exactly. They're the most unified. They're unified in their fanaticism.
Right. And basically it can be demonstrated, and maybe we'll do that next week, that the most radical minority within the leftist coalition, or and that's this was actually called the Popular Front in Spain, which the Republic was made of, the coalition parties that made up the majority, which was leftist and radical. But the most radical among them, they actually just use the rest of them.
Useful idiots.
Well, right, so that they can continue to agitate for pure Bolshevism. And that's exactly what they that's what they do. That they and we see that here in America, where the Democratic Party, most Democrats are not Marxists, but we have the most radical wing, the Chuck Schumer, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, actually the tail wags the dog, and it does, and they happen to be at the forefront of Democratic politics, and they are right now. We're going to follow this Barnes Review article, which is actually a pretty good overview of the Spanish Civil War. It's from 1996, The Great Preliminary Bout, The Spanish Civil War by Eric Norling and George Fowler. What would you like to start, or do you want me to?
You can start if you want.
The Spanish Civil War proved to be the momentous ideological and cultural flashpoint of the 1930s, striking deeply into the consciousness of the West. It represented the first armed confrontation between the form of nationalism that came to be called fascism and communism. And they even seemed to buy the fact that most of Franco's forces were fascist, and they were not. To the respective banners rallied Western traditionalists, Catholics, and non-fascist anti-communists of the right, liberal idealists, vague utopians, and non-communist anti-fascists of the left. For the first time in European history, thousands of foreign volunteers rallied to face each other in a land strange to them. Alfonso XIII abandoned the Spanish throne in 1931. From 1923 until January 28, 1930, Spain was ruled by General Primo de Rivera's benevolent and traditionalist military dictatorship. Following considerable internal dissent, a Republican Socialist coalition was elected on June 28, 1931. A single-chamber parliament, called the Cortes, began functioning under a new and liberal constitution. Left communist influence grew in Madrid, and on January 6, 1936, the Cortes was dissolved.
This sounds like a repeat of what they tried, what they did in Russia. They get rid of the Tsar, and they bring about a transitional provisional government.
Exactly.
Duma, and then they get rid of the Duma and bring about a civil war.
Exactly. The leftist parties, Republican, Socialist, Syndicalist, and Communist, combined to form a Popular Front, totally unacceptable to Spanish traditionalists. That's what it set it off, and the left set it off, just like they did in Russia. The Spanish Civil War began in effect on July 18, 1936, with an army revolt at Melilla, I'm probably destroying that, in Spanish Morocco. Melilla in Spanish Morocco. The revolt spread rapidly to Spain's garrison cities and towns, such as Cadiz, Seville, Zaragoza, and Burgos. The parties of the left, already strongly influenced by Soviet and international communist pressures and support, united to resist the rightist uprising. Antagonisms were heightened by the Republican government's confiscation of all religious properties. Isn't that what they did in France after the revolution? And isn't that what the Bolsheviks ultimately did in Russia?
Well, it's the Bolshevik Revolution in Spain.
Absolutely. The insurgent leaders, Generals Francisco Franco and Emilio Mola, were supported by the military, save for most non-commissioned officers. A formidable Moorish force in Spanish Morocco, the Army of Africa, numbered about 32,000, half of them required for domestic duty. towards war's end, some 300,000 Moroccan troops would be fighting alongside the nationalists, and Spain's civil population was deeply divided. Thus began a crucially important civil war of no-quarter brutality and agony that would last until Franco's triumph with the fall of Madrid on March 28th. '39. Both sides received massive outside assistance so that they might keep up the fight. The nationalist right was supported mainly by Germany, Italy, and to a much lesser extent, neighboring Portugal, which was ruled by its longtime folk dictator, Antonio Salazar. The Republicans were supported mainly by the Soviets and the leftist governments of France. And again, and that was Leon Blum, the Jewish government of France. And again, to a much lesser extent, by Mexico. The forces of international finance and fundraising weighed heavily on the Republican side. Are you surprised at that?
Not at all.
Of course not.
And the West made a pretense, though, of having an arms embargo against both sides, didn't they?
Well, to me, yes, they did. They did make that pretense, but that was because there were a lot of Catholics in the United States who knew that Franco's supporters were the Catholic traditionalists of Spain, and Roosevelt could not upset his Catholic voters because that was his base. The Northeast Catholics were Roosevelt's primary base that he launched his that they were his core voters.
Basically, most of the Democrats at the time, most of the Catholics were Democrats, weren't they?
An honest examination of the politics of the Spanish Civil War will demonstrate that the capitalists were using communism to defeat fascism. In other words, fascism was the reaction to the capitalist raping of Europe. And the capitalists tried to use communism to contain it. And when communism failed, they had to lure England and America into a war against Germany. That's the way I look at it.
Well, the people didn't take to communism like they thought they would.
Right.
Instead, they rallied around Franco, Mussolini, Salazar, and Hitler.
And it ultimately gave the Rothschilds control over the entire West, which they have to this day.
But had it not been for those four people, Portugal would have been the Portuguese Soviet Socialist Republic, Spain would have been the Spanish Soviet Socialist Republic, Italy would have been the Italian Soviet Socialist Republic, and Germany would have been the German Soviet Socialist Republic.
Well, absolutely. And Ireland and Britain and Scotland would not have been spared.
There would have been an Icelandic Soviet Socialist Republic.
There may have been a Greenlandic and a Canadian.
And then eventually there would have been Oregon Soviet Socialist Republic.
It would have been all right, exactly. They wanted the whole world. Bolshevism wanted. They got it the slow way,
mm-hmm.
but they wanted it a lot faster than they got it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they have it now. They're 99% of the way there.
But haven't they gone on the record in the 20s and 30s saying that the revolution will spread across the world? Didn't Marx write just as much?
Yes, they did. And this is all coming from the same Jews that brought us the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And it's our own ignorance and failure to look past what the Jewish media is espousing that allowed it to happen.
Well, all we have to do is listen to what they're saying. They're pretty open about their intentions.
Well, they're open about their intentions, but the average person doesn't read what they say. The average person's reads what they're given. They're not given this information in the everyday in USA Today and on CNN.
Well, as I was telling my dad earlier, the Jews generally have trouble keeping secrets. They like to brag and show that they know something special. So whenever they're plotting, they're usually pretty proud and boastful, and they're usually open about their plotting. So all we have to do is listen to what they say, and then, of course, watch what they do, and it's pretty obvious they're moving against us.
Well, it's absolutely obvious. Once your eyes are open to it, most people refuse to see it. That they are God's chosen people. That they're above, for that reason, they are above inspection. And most mainstream Christians believe that. That's the power of propaganda. It's an amazing thing. Prior to the war, a major factor was the May 2nd, 1935 signing of the Soviet-French Treaty of Mutual Assistance under the Jewish Leon Blum. In it, both powers promised immediate mutual consultation if either were threatened. In June 1936, a Popular Front government under Leon Blum in France took the reins in Paris. Oh, I'm sorry. Leon Blum wasn't in power yet.
It's an anti-German agreement, isn't it?
Well, it's absolutely right. The French were afraid of German belligerence towards France and for what went on in the Rhineland and they sought help from the Soviets and an alliance with the Soviets against Germany.
They might as well just call it the anti-German alliance.
Yes. I thought Leon Blum was in power, though, when it was signed. I'm wrong.
He was in, and then he was out for a while, and then he was back in.
Well, I'm sure the same Jews behind Leon Blum had a lot to do with it. In June 1936, a Popular Front government under Leon Blum took the reins in Paris, thereby assuring Republican, quote-unquote, Spain, a warm liaison across the Pyrenees. On August 5th, 1936, Germany's Chancellor Adolf Hitler met with and expressed his concerns to a prominent Breton, Sir John Vansittart, who during World War II would become a BBC propagandist. The Englishman later recalled, "He thought the left in Spain would eventually win. If his prediction were verified, France would be infected dangerously, perhaps desperately. And the contagion," meaning the Bolshevik contagion, "would then spread to their associates like Czechoslovakia, where the seed was already sown. Germany would then be caught between two, if not three, fires and must be prepared." And one of those fires is already burning in Moscow. Hitler's ambassador to Britain and his subsequent foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop, wrote that on July 26, 1936, Hitler told him, "Germany could not tolerate a communist Spain under any circumstances. If a communist state actually does emerge, in view of the current situation in France, the Bolshevism of that country is also only a matter of a short time in Germany, with the Soviet Union in the east and a strong communist bloc in the west, can einpacken," meaning pack up. In his famed The Spanish Civil War, Hugh Thomas wrote that Soviet war material was first used in Spain in October 1936. In 1956, the Soviet government stated that the long-gone Spanish Republican government owed it $50 million on top of monetary gold reserves equal to 63 million British pounds sent them in 1936. In October 1938, General Franco estimated, from captured weapons and other sources, that the Spanish communists had obtained the following across the French border: 198 cannon, 200 tanks, 3,247 machine guns, 4,000 trucks, some 9,500 other vehicles, 47 artillery units. There's usually about 200 guys in a military unit, isn't there?
And what? In an artillery unit?
About 200 soldiers, roughly. I don't know. 4,565 tons of munitions and 14,889 tons of fuel. This land-delivered material came mostly from Russia, Czechoslovakia, and the United States, although President Roosevelt had declared an embargo on arms to Spain. The French government also supplied some 200 aircraft to Republican Spain. Figures on Soviet sea deliveries are somewhat vague. In 1936 and 37, most Republican Air Force planes were flown by Soviet pilots, subsequently by Spaniards. Much of the aid to both sides arrived irregularly. For instance, German military figures show that in January 1938, the Republicans received 15,400 tons of gasoline from the Soviets, 7,200 tons of crude oil from the United Kingdom, and 4,650 tons of lubricants from Greece. So even Greece was feeding the Republicans, the communists in Spain.
And with all that stuff getting over the French border, I suppose that the French government was doing the best they could, and that, well, what didn't get through isn't listed.
Robert H. Wheely wrote in Hitler in Spain that as of September 12 to 14, 1936, it became official Soviet policy to send military aid to the Republican government in Spain. Shortly thereafter, on September 25th, in violation of the spirit of the non-aggression agreement, the first of five Russian ships, the Neva, arrived in Republican Spain with food, secret arms, and munitions. According to Italian intelligence reporting from Alicante, the Neva unloaded 3,000 cases of rifles, 4,000 cases of ammunition, and various boxes of aviation equipment on September 29th. Wheely wrote, so basically the Spanish Civil War was a Bolshevik foothold in Western Europe. There's no doubt. Wheely wrote that one good way of measuring foreign intervention over the course of the Spanish Civil War is to compare the money spent or loaned on both sides for military aid. The Soviets utilized some $518 million in Spanish gold via the Bank of Spain to pay what Russia charged the Republic for the services of the international brigades. So there you have it. Russia charged Spain for the international brigades.
Russia basically bankrupted Spain.
Right, exactly. They were stealing all their money in exchange for communist services worldwide. That's incredible. Plus a $65 million Soviet loan. Axis credit included 540 million German Reichsmarks, $215 million in 1930s dollars. And this surprised me. Plus 6.8 billion Italian lira, or $354 million, totaling $569 million. A large part of the Spanish gold was re-exported to the Banque Commerciale pour l'Europe du Nord in Paris for the Madrid government to draw on. Wheely says the figures don't include private contributions from leftists and communists in the West, and I'm sure they were high, or nationalist payments to its Moroccan troops.
Well, I'm sure every leftist foundation and every Hollywood celebrity was engaged in a benefit drive or, you know, whatever the equivalent back then of a charity concert would be for our heroes fighting fascism in Spain.
Well, that's the next paragraph. In terms of attracting both contributions and volunteers to the fight, the communist side enjoyed a decided edge relative to both media bias in many countries and glamorous celebrity activist fundraisers. These included famed writer and Republican ambulance driver Ernest Hemingway, Jewish artist Pablo Picasso.
He had to be a Jew. His art was filthy.
Oh, yes, he was a Jew. Black communist baritone Paul Robeson. Did he ever actually sing?
Paul Robeson made the most famous English language singing of the Soviet anthem.
Well, okay, that's
and
what he sang.
Now they're naming high schools after him all across the country.
Yeah, it's incredible. And well, he was a black man. I mean, if he could read, I guess that's an accomplishment. He's a school named after you. And French literary lion André Malraux, who formed his own but ineffective air squadron. Fundraising in such moneyed circles as Hollywood was stimulated not only by many Jewish film figures, but leftist stars such as Frederick March, Myrna Loy, and James Cagney. And they mentioned that Cagney turned sharply to the right in his later years. Well, that's a little too late probably. Huh? President Roosevelt, although continually badgered by his wife Eleanor, his ugly wife, Eleanor.
She was a Jew.
She looked like a guy. I don't know how he married her, even him. To lift the arms embargo on Republican Spain, never moved in that direction. In the 1930s, American Catholic voters were largely Democratic on Election Day, and the great majority of parishioners sided with the strongly anti-communist clergy, particularly as atrocities committed against priests and nuns and the looting and burning of churches became known. However, according to Peter Wyden's The Passionate War, the priest wondered at a cabinet meeting after the fall of Madrid to the Nationalists whether the government should simply have prohibited transport in American flagships. In other words, let them have the arms, just don't send them in ships with our flag on them.
Isn't that what they did with Britain? The but the British had to come and pick it up and take it back. They had some nice little euphemism coined for it, but they were basically supplying Britain with all the arms they could get their hands on in violation of the neutrality that was declared with Germany.
Yes, it was, and there were many more violations of the neutrality declared with Germany than that.
I think Rosenfeld, he wanted a war, and he did everything possible to engineer a war. He even eventually ordered American destroyers and armed merchantmen to sink German U-boats on site, and this was in 1940.
Well, on the front page of my Mein Kampf site, there is a page from Life magazine which announces, basically, the preparation. America gets ready to fight Germany, Italy, and Japan. And that was from Life magazine, October 31st, 1938. So go figure that one out. Go figure how Life magazine could publish that 3 years before Pearl Harbor. America gets ready to fight Germany, Italy, and Japan. Life magazine. 3 years before, 38 months before Pearl Harbor. That's just incredible. And people don't see that today.
Oh. And the Rosenfeld policy was cash and carry. The ships had to come to the U.S. and then they could leave with whatever goods they wanted to buy. Of course, Germany couldn't do that since the Royal Navy controlled the Atlantic. So it was effectively saying we're going to aid Britain and only Britain.
It's incredible. The bankers knew and the leading political figures knew, and the leading Jews knew that we were going into this war. There's no doubt. And they knew it long before. They knew it in 1933 when they declared it. Because I'm sure that Satan was pretty confident then that he would get us to kill our brothers. Okay. On the Nationalist side, their limited air force was enormously and crucially backstopped by the presence of Germany's Condor Legion and the Italian Expeditionary Air Force. The Condor Legion, according to Hugh Thomas, reached a maximum of 10,000 personnel in the autumn of 1936 and averaged about 3,000 throughout the war. As is well known, air action in Spain proved a vital testing ground for the fledgling Luftwaffe. The total number of Germans who participated in Spain came to 16,000, many of them civilian experts and instructors, kind of like we started out in Vietnam.
Yeah.
The Condor Legion lost about 300 men in air combat. Some 14,000 veterans marched in the Condor Legion's victory parade in Berlin following the Nationalist victory. Germany also sent 30 anti-tank companies. Colonel von Thoma, who commanded the German tank corps, told the Americans in 1945 that he had experienced 192 tank engagements in Spain. I'm sure he was probably being tortured at Nuremberg when he told them that. Huh? The Italian contingent, true volunteers, and quote-unquote volunteers dispatched by Benito Mussolini, numbered about 55,000, of whom 6,000 were killed. In 1941, Italy's usually reliable Stefani news agency reported that Italy had sent 763 aircraft to Spain, plus large numbers of aircraft motors, bombs, ammunition, guns, rifles, and sidearms, plus 7,663 vehicles. Its air force, where the best and most courageous were largely gathered, flew 135,265 pilot hours, participated in 5,318 air raids, hit 224 ships and brought down 903 planes. I'd say that probably outdid their World War II performance. All told, Italy's Air Force provided the Nationalists with 5,699 officers and men plus 312 civilian personnel. Mussolini, they have a bad rep from World War II, I'm sorry. Mussolini placed his black shirt legions under General Mario Roatta, who had been chief of Italian intelligence. Many fought well, but great numbers broke in panic on occasion. Rawada reported that the best Red troops were international volunteers because they fought with fierce hatred. His Italians, Rawada concluded, lacked motivation. You want to pick this up?
All right. Over the years, a great deal has been made of Republican side volunteers. Among them were communists, classless society theorists. They might as well just call them communists as well.
They might as well call them Jews.
Exactly. And a mix of leftist sympathizers with a yen for adventure in the midst of a gray depression. In other words, they wanted to go to Spain and kill a bunch of nuns and priests.
Exactly.
Some 40,000 foreign volunteers fought with the communist-controlled Republicans. There were approximately 3,000 Jewish volunteers in the international brigades. And I wonder if they were the first ones in, the shock troops, or if they just came in after the men were dead so they could go after the women.
I'm sure they were clerks.
Or they were there to get the gold from Spain and send it to Moscow.
Yeah.
Some 3,200 American citizens enlisted in the international brigades, mostly in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. The first 76 of these sailed from New York on the French liner Normandie and arrived at Le Havre, with some irony, on Christmas Eve, 1936. About 1,500 of them made it back to the U.S. Cecil's Ebby between the bullet and the lie. States that the leftist volunteers were victims of their own military leadership as well as nationalist firepower. Ebby wrote, "The large number of Jewish intellectuals aboard the Normandie were abysmally green. All had done their stint on picket lines and were up on party theory, but few had ever fired a rifle," end quote. And most of them, in my words, they thought that they could learn war by fighting war, and war is not the kind of place for on-the-job training. Come ready to fight or don't come at all.
I think that it's ironic that they sailed on a French ship named the Normandy to go fight fascism in Spain. and the English, you know, the American invasion at Normandy was you know, 15 years later against Hitler's against Hitler's fascist government in France. I don't know. There's some poetic irony there.
And the English used to own Normandy.
Yes.
Hugh Thomas's research concluded that the largest contingent in the international brigades were the 10,000 French, of whom 3,000 were killed. But remember, France is neutral, and the Jews in France are keeping their people in line. About 5,000 German and Austrian communists and leftists went to Spain, of whom 2,000 were killed. There were also about 1,000 Canadians, 1,200 Yugoslavs, and about 1,000 each of Hungarians and Scandinavians. Now, I imagine that translates to Jews from Hungary and Jews from Yugoslavia. Among Americans, the right did not have rallied to the nationalist banner centers remotely comparable to the National Maritime Union and some other union halls, certain campus centers, as well as communist and some Jewish organizations. The Catholic clergy and its school systems were strongly opposed to Republican Spain, but stopped short of encouraging young Americans to take up arms. No members of the German-American Bund are known to have gone to Spain. Some sources claim one American pilot flew for the nationalists and was killed early in the war. As is often observed, the winners write the histories. The fascist side won Spain's war, but before the end of that summer, World War II had begun, its winners setting the historical tone and ground rules. Thus, the saga of the nationalist volunteers was swept silently into the dustbins. The Spanish nationalists and their foreign volunteers were depicted by post-war historians and propagandists, which of course includes documentary producers, as simple puppets of the Axis powers. When not ignored, they have been vilified. Many were primarily anti-communists, placing themselves on the line against the international plague that Mussolini termed the disease of the 20th century. But others, rather than being unwitting tools of fascism, saw that ideology as a positive answer to their respective nation's future. Many had witnessed either the triumph or the threat of communism in their own countries. So, of course, these people are going to go here to try and stop it from spreading to Spain. If a fire burns down your farm and it's spreading to your neighbor's farm, wouldn't you want to save your neighbor's farm? It's only
absolutely.
These foreign volunteers who fought on the nationalist side would become the war's forgotten fighters. The largest group was Portuguese, calling themselves the Legion de Viriatos, in remembrance of a guerrilla leader who had fought the Roman invaders. Hugh Thomas states that these numbered some 20,000 of whom 8,000 were killed. At least 4,000 Portuguese fought in the ranks of the Spanish Foreign Legion, Banderas de Falange, and the Royalist units, Precios Frequentes, in which foreigners could enlist. It has been calculated that between 600 and 700 of those died fighting in their adjoining country. They were mostly nationalists, but included many members of the Portuguese Fascist Party. Frenchmen provided the second largest nationalist contingent. Some 1,000 volunteers enlisted in the Spanish Foreign Legion. The others formed an independent unit, Compania Juana de Arco, named for the French heroine of the Middle Ages. Former Tsarist military officers received commissions on the nationalist side. A white Russian contingent of company strength, some 200, sought vengeance against the Soviet-backed Republicans. There were also a number of individuals from various Eastern European countries who had come to know and despise communism. Hundreds of French volunteers fell in action, were badly wounded, or were captured. Many of the surviving French volunteers would fight communism again in World War II on the Eastern Front, members of the French Volunteer Legion against Bolshevism. 600 men of the Irish Free State fought the Reds in Spain under Ireland's fascist blue shirt leader, Éowyn O'Duffy. Most of the Irishmen were part of O'Duffy's organization, but a number were adventurers who wanted to fight on the Catholic side. Evidently, no more than a dozen British subjects fought for Franco. The British probably wouldn't let anybody go. They had to sneak out.
Right. Okay. Actually, the Welshmen, there's a movie on the Mein Kampf site I downloaded, Wales in the Spanish Civil War, and there's several reasons why I liked the movie. I mean, I don't like the attitude of the Welshmen. That they actually equated Christianity and communism, which is their idea of communism based on what they were hearing. While Christianity is a community religion where we should share our wealth with each other, there's a huge difference between Christianity and communism. Communism is evil. Well, anyway, these Welshmen actually did tell the authorities at the borders that they were going to Paris for the weekend. And not they did not tell them, they couldn't tell them that they were going to fight in Spain.
Of these, most were at least half Irish. These included former British Army officers and men of academic accomplishment. The Romanian Fascist Party, the Iron Guard, dispatched a select unit of volunteers. They fought for a year until conditions at home required their recall. One American woman volunteer in red-held Madrid showed incredible selfless courage, and had she been a figure of the left, would no doubt have become a celebrated heroine courtesy of the Western media. Her name was Helen Walker, the daughter of an ITT engineer in Spain who had married Antonio Garrigues y Díaz Canabate, a Spanish nationalist nobleman lawyer. Peter Wyden wrote that the couple had joined a nationalist resistance cell. They sheltered 7 nuns in their basement and arranged for food and hiding places for nationalist fugitives. Just before Madrid fell to the nationalists, the couple used their clandestine influence to prevent last-minute firing squad executions of imprisoned rightists. So had they been putting Jews in their attic, there'd be a movie about them, but we don't even know about these people.
Right. If they were putting Jews in their attic, some kike actor would have gotten an Academy Award portraying them.
They'd have a diary. They had this lady, Helen Walker. We'd have the diary of Helen Walker written in ballpoint ink, no doubt.
Yes, in ballpoint pen. No, on Microsoft Word. Are you kidding?
With the surrender of the communist-dominated leftist coalition, a number of its troops fled north across the Pyrenees to France. They operated against the Germans during World War II with the leftist or communist elements of the Maquis terrorist underground. And I'd like to say that it seems to me there were enough genuine Frenchmen in the French resistance to fill a phone booth. They were all Jews. And they did the only thing they were good at, setting off bombs and terrorizing people.
Everywhere they go.
Many foreign volunteers who had fought for the nationalists would subsequently fight the Soviets in the snows of Finland, on the Russian front, and even in the streets of Berlin in 1945. The largest number would don the gray uniform of the Waffen-SS in the titanic struggle to come. In all, some 600,000 Spaniards and foreigners were killed. A sixth of these fell as a result of summary executions, to give slaughter a somewhat pristine reference. With World War II approaching, the guns of Spain were silenced. Hitler was severely dismayed that Franco did not join the Axis cause. Franco felt that his country was psychologically and physically incapable of what would be required. Had he joined Germany and Italy, given the situation that would have caused relative to Britain's Mediterranean lifeline, Churchill might indeed have been forced to accept peace in the West following Dunkirk, his FDR administration's alliance notwithstanding. In this course, Franco and his Falange Party associates were helped immeasurably by Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, Germany's double-dealing intelligence chief. And that man was a traitor to his people and his nation, wouldn't you say?
Well, what do you do? What do you expect when you take somebody named Canaris and put him into a position like that?
Canaris, you think he was a Jew?
Well, yes, I think he was a Jew. And the word is related to the word canary, and it comes from the Latin word canis, and it means dog. You don't take a dog and put him in charge of your intelligence. I'm making a pun. But yes, Canaris was a traitor to Germany.
You don't take the children's bread and cast it to the dogs.
Right. Canaris was a traitor to Germany. And he wasn't alone. Hitler had several, that there were several generals that were traitors.
I think Erhard Milch, he was definitely half Jewish, and it turned out later he was likely full Jewish, but they put him in charge of Germany's fighter production. No wonder they never had a large enough air force.
Right. There were several traitors that betrayed Germany that it's still possible that without the betrayal that Germany suffered, she may have won the war or prolonged it for some time to come.
In any event, the little-remembered sacrifices of the Spanish Reich, its foreign volunteers and Moroccan troops, as well as the crucial assistance of Germany and Italy, kept the Iberian Peninsula and probably much more of Europe beyond the Soviet bear's claws. And that's the end of the article. And I would say we shouldn't say Soviet bear's claws. We should say the fangs of the Jewish serpent.
Well, right. And that's, you know, this is a mainstream article, even though it's in the Barnes Review. Even these people overestimate the fascist element in Franco's, on the nationalist side, I think is grossly overestimated. While the Falange was not that big a party, and it grew rapidly when the war began, but it was not that big a party, and most of Franco's supporters were nationalists and Catholics, and they were not fascists. Spain did not have the same economy that Germany and the other nations where many more people embraced fascism had. They had
Spain
a very
agrarian traditionalist.
Yes, they were agrarian traditionalists, and they were very heavily Catholic. And I'm not sure if fascism and Catholicism even go hand in hand that well. Maybe it worked in Italy, but it didn't. Everything that I've read tells me that only about a quarter of Franco's supporters were actually fascists.
Most of them were just middle Spaniards, just ordinary citizens, farmers.
Right. Well, let's look at some of the parties. And I have a list of political parties here right from Wikipedia, and I read much the same thing in other sources on the internet, which is why I kept the Wikipedia list. The Francoist parties. Virtually all nationalist groups had very strong Roman Catholic convictions and supported the native Spanish clergy. The Union Militar Española, the Spanish Military Union, a conservative political organization of officers in the armed forces, including outspoken critics of the Republic, like Francisco Franco. He was not a fascist. He was a conservative traditionalist. Formed in 1934, from its inception, the UME secretly courted fascist Italy. That doesn't make them fascists. After the electoral victory of the Popular Front, it began plotting a coup with monarchist and fascist groups in Spain. That is why I made it a point to bring up at the beginning of the program that this really, the trouble in Spain began in 1931 when leftist parties took over control of the government, and a lot of those leftists were actually Bolsheviks. And the conservatives in Spain knew that. And they knew what these leftists were that they were trying to ultimately Bolshevize Spain. And that is why there was a coup against them.
Well, there had to be a coup, or Spain would have become a Soviet republic.
Well, right, absolutely. It had to be nipped in the bud, and they did it, and they stood up and did it, and the Jews worldwide hated them for it, and that's why we have all the propaganda against Franco in the media in the years leading up to 1936 and during the Spanish Civil War. And that's why we have basically a unified media voice on the side of quote-unquote democratic Spain. And it's all a lie. It's all a lie to cover up the fact that the Soviets tried to Bolshevize Spain.
And
did it just like they did it in Russia, in stages, just like you pointed out. Let's get rid of the monarchy. Let's put in this temporary government, and then we're going to radicalize it. And that's exactly what they did. And when they did that, Franco and raised up an army and revolted against them.
In fact, the temporary government they put in, most of those people wound up purged, and in fact, there was a large anarchist faction that the communists ended up turning on. So there wound up being a civil war within the civil war, since the arch-communists and the Bolsheviks, they turned on the social revolutionaries, the left radicals, the socialists, the social democrats, and the anarchists.
Well, absolutely. And the left, the Popular Front in Spain, was very splintered also, and we're going to see that. The second group listed as members of Franco's coalition is the Alfonsist monarchists. They supported the restoration of Alfonso XIII, who had abdicated in 1931. And many army officers, aristocrats, and landowners were amongst these people, but there was little other popular support. The Renovación Española, the Spanish Restoration, and that's the main Alfonsist monarchist political party. The Acción Española, the Spanish Action, an integral nationalist party led by José Calvo Sotelo, formed in 1933 around a journal of the same name, edited by Ramiro de Maeztu, and they are not fascists. The National Bloc was the militia movement founded by that same person, José Calvo Sotelo, the Spanish Action Group. The Carlist monarchists. Now, let me say that the Carlists, they were around since 1830-something. There were three Carlist wars in the 1830s, and I'm sorry, in the 1800s, between, like, I think it might be 1836 and 1872. That these people were around a long time, the Carlist monarchists, supported by Alfonso Carlos de Borbón y Austria Estes's claim to the Spanish throne, and saw the Alfonsine line as having been weakened by liberalism. After Alfonso Carlos died without issue, the Carlists split, some supporting Carlos's appointed regent and others supporting Alfonso XIII or the Falange. The Carlists were clerical hardliners led by the aristocracy with a populist base amongst the farmers and rural workers of Navarre, providing the militia. So they had a base beyond the aristocracy. The Communion Tradicionalista, Traditionalist Communion, the Carlist political party. They had the Requetz, which is a militia movement volunteer. The Palayos is a militant youth movement. Margaritas, a woman's movement named after Margarita de Bourbon Parma, the wife of a Carlist pretender, Charles VII, 1868 to 1909. The Falange, which is the Falange Española, which is the fascist party in Spain, created by a merger in 1934 of two fascist organizations, Primo de Rivera's Falange, founded in 1933, and Ramiro Ledesma's Junta, Assemblies of the National Syndicalist Offensive, founded in 1931. It became a mass movement when it was joined by members of Acción Popular and Acción Catholica, led by Ramón Serrano Suner. So that's the fascist the purely fascist faction in on the Franco side. The feminine section of women's movement in labor of social aid, the Falange Española Tradicionalista, created by a merger in 1937 of the Falange and the Carlist Party, bringing the remaining political and militia components of the nationalist side under Franco's ultimate authority. And CEDA, the Coalition Party, CEDA, it's an acronym, the Coalition Party founded by José María Gil Robles y Quiñones, whose ideology ranges from Christian democracy to conservative. Although they supported Franco's rebellion, the party was dissolved in 1937 after most members and militants joined the Falange and Gil Robles went into exile. Let me say that CEDA was a mainstream party under the Republic. Before that, they were around for a long time. They were traditionalists who were around before the war began, and they actually had most of the votes in the November 1932 election, but the president of Spain wouldn't let them form a government. The leftist president would not let them form a government, and that's one of the reasons, that was one of the causes in the build-up to the war.
Well, isn't that the same today? The Jews love democracy as long as their parties get elected.
Well, right, and the CEDA, that party, what was a traditionalist conservative party, and it was more like a general conservative party, but they got more votes than any other party in November 1932, but the leftist president would not let them form a government. And that was part of the, and that was something I was going to get to probably next week, because I'm not really prepared for it this week.
All right. So next week, should we deal with the buildup to the war and the conditions prevailing in Europe at the time?
Yes, I think we gave an overview, and yes, we probably should do that.
And maybe we could do a little information on how the global economic depression of the time was impacting Spain, or if it was, since it had basically, in the early 30s, Germany was devastated, wasn't it, until it took Hitler a few years to get things back on track.
Well, yes, and there were problems in Spain, there's no doubt. There were there was a huge class of agrarian workers that had basically lived in poverty for many, many centuries. There's little doubt about that. There was 70% of the land was held by 4% of the people. But, 4% of the people did not help Franco's side to victory. It took a lot more than 4% of the people for the nationalists to prevail in the Spanish Civil War. So they definitely had a broader support than simply the aristocracy. That there was definitely most of the middle class was heavily anti-communist.
Absolutely. That's the case in most countries, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Because the communists, they really just want to destroy the fabric of the nation and destroy the middle class.
Under the guise of liberating the middle class and the lower classes, they destroy them and enslave them.
Well, we saw what the Bolsheviks did in Russia. Destroyed the entire middle class.
They destroyed the entire nation, basically.
And put the property of the nation into the hands of the Jews.
Hmm.
It's radical Talmudism is what.
Well, that's why there's no communism in Israel, because they don't need it. Communism's a tool that the Jew uses to steal your stuff from you. He doesn't need it to steal anything from his own kin, does he?
Well, without a doubt. I mean, the Talmud tells the Jew that he can take the property of the Goyim, and Bolshevism and communism are the devices that he uses to do that. Because capitalism works, but it works far too slowly.
Or evangelical Christianity, get them to voluntarily part with their property.
Yeah, right.
Send your money to Israel to help feed a starving Jewish Holocaust survivor. All right, then. Do you have any closing thoughts, sir?
No, I'm good.
All right. Yahweh bless. See you next week. Yeah. Oh, next week it'll be at what, 8 p.m. then?
Yes, 8 o'clock next week. We're going to move this program up to 8 o'clock.
Okay, great. 8 p.m. Eastern. See you there. Yahweh bless.
Praise Yahweh.